Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. I'm Jerry Shario, and really looking forward to today's episode for a number of reasons, not the least being I get to spend time talking to this guy. I'd like to present a multi-talented actor, director, star of stage, screen, and television, but since he couldn't be here today, here's Nick Santamaria.
Hey, thank you. One, two, three, hit it. On a wonderful day like today, it's the day that I talk to my brother's toupee, and everyone knows that my sister is gay. On a wonderful day like today. Hey, how's your drink? That's great. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Jerry. Hi, Nick.
I just thought I was in Vegas again. I just, you know, it comes back every so often, you know, like shell shock, you know.
Yes, they have medication for that these days.
So I hear, actually. So I hear. And sometimes I don't hear because I put the pills in my ears.
Ooh,
yes, which reminds me of this, one of my favorite bits in this film.
Yes.
Bud Abbott and Lou Costello in Hollywood. Now, there is a question about the title of this film.
Yes.
I think of it as the first of their name films, where they include their names in the film. Abbott and Costello Meet, Abbott and Costello
right.
In, Abbott and Costello Are. So Matthew Conium believes it began with In the Navy. But In the Navy, if you really look at it, is actually titled Bud Abbott, Lou Costello, and Dick Powell in the Navy. Now, I doubt there were like groups of children in front of the movie theater saying, you know what? I've got a dime. Let's go see Bud Abbott, Lou Costello, and Dick Powell in the Navy. And by the time he gets done, his friends are gone. They're seeing Brown and Carney down the street.
They must be desperate to go to see Brown and Carney. I'll tell you that. And it must have been hard getting all that on the marquee, too. Bud Abbott, Lou Costello, Dick. Yeah, yeah.
It was the world's longest marquee, actually.
Yeah. And,
he was even longer than that tall marquee from France. I forget his name, Pierre or something. So we're moving on. So this is Bud Abbott and Lou Costello in Hollywood. Now, I want to bring this up before I forget. This movie is practically, and this is according to my co-writer, Matthew Conium, for our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, he brings up the point that this is practically a remake of A Night at the Opera with the March.
I beg your pardon?
Now, oh, yes. See, I note your eyebrows going up and down at this point.
Yeah.
With pure, you know, curiosity. So I will let you know the details of this.
Okay.
You've got Lispari, right? The villain.
Okay.
He's an egomaniac. He wants the girl. He wants Rosa. He's vindictive. He doesn't like, Alan Jones. So, okay, you've got that. That's Gregory LeMay's in our movie, in this movie. Mm-hmm. Alan Jones could be Robert Stanton in this movie. Jeff in this movie. They're both after the successful girl who was Rosa in A Night at the Opera. Kitty Carlisle. Here she's Frances Rafferty. She's now a movie star who wants to get her boyfriend into the movies. And then you have Kavanaugh, Donald McBride's character, mm-hmm. is basically Sig Ruman.
Perhaps someday when he makes a reputation,
but yeah, he's an American version of Sig Ruman's Gottlieb. And Chico is Abbott and Costello. They become his agent and manager, just like Chico did for Ricardo Baroni in A Night at the Opera. So this is basically A Night at the Opera.
Okay.
I looked at it in a whole new way last night when I was watching. So yeah, I find that very interesting, A Night at the Opera. Huh? But it is 1945. It is 10 years later. And also interestingly, this is a movie that Buster Keaton worked on with the boys. It was not one of his favorite jobs. He found the boys rather loose in their approach to comedy. I remember him quoting, he's in an interview and he's saying, oh, they used to get my goat. When we made movies, we ate them and we slept them, we dreamed them, you know. But those days were long over. Hollywood had become a factory town rather than a place where great artists could take their time making films during the silent days. So yeah, that's pretty much what killed Buster Keaton, but it was working well for Abbott and Costello. They worked well within the machine. But at this point, they were so tired of working at MGM. They did not like it there. It was just a little too highfalutin, too many rules. Lou would complain about having to learn the script, to learn his lines. He's like, what am I doing? And at Universal, I never had to learn lines. You told me what the scene was about. We walked in and we did it, you know? And I tell you the truth, some people find that lazy. Some people find it sloppy, like Buster Keaton. But to tell you the truth, I work the same way. I love to just give me the essence and let me go in and play. And that's what they did best, especially Lou, who was one of the great improvisers of his era, even this era. So let's look at the players here in the background. We've got our Marx Brother connection, our friend Nat Perrin. If you remember Nat Perrin, if you know your Marx Brothers, I believe it was in Chicago. He was in the audience watching Animal Crackers, and he had drafted a forged letter of recommendation from George S. Kaufman for Groucho, sent it backstage, and Groucho sent for him, and they became fast friends. And Groucho invited him to Hollywood, where he worked on the radio show Flywheel, Scheister and Flywheel. A lot of that material was used in Monkey Business, which Nat worked on. And so Nat Perrin was the Marx Brother connection there. And by this time, he was writing for Abbott and Costello. He was writing, Pardon My Sarong before this, one of their zaniest movies. And this one he was very involved in. Now, there is another person involved, a name that confuses most Abbott and Costello fans, unless you're a fan of their radio show. This movie was produced by a guy by the name of Martin Gosch. Now, I'm guessing the pronunciation. It's G-O-S-C-H. Now, it's either Gosch, which would make him a human exclamation. look, here comes Gosch. Or it could be Gosch, which could describe some of his films. But no, I think it's like Gosch. You know, Martin. We'll call him Martin.
Martin, yeah.
So Marty was the producer of their radio show, Abbott and Costello show at NBC. He was also a writer on the show. Now, Nat Perrin told this story into his old age. He said that Martin Gosch walked into L.B. Mayer's office and said two words, barbershop. The boys are in a barbershop. And for some reason, L.B. Mayer went nuts and said, start building a movie around that. Well, he said that Martin Gosch, never produced a movie before.
Yeah.
This just seems extremely unlikely, mostly because, number one, it was very difficult to get into L.B. Mayer's office, even with an appointment. And number two, he was nobody that was known, basically. He was producing for radio. He was interesting, though. He was an interesting guy. He did kind of talk his way into this, and he got the producer's credit, produced by Martin A. Gosch. So, yeah, there you go.
I will say one thing that surprised me in the opening credits, the lack of a certain name.
This is what I was going to next.
I had a feeling.
One person was not invited to the party. Actually, I believe he was busy working on other projects at Universal. But our pal John Grant is not aboard. And can I say one thing about that might not sit well with fans? I like the change. Basically, Perrin and Lou Breslow was the co-writer here, not Martin Gosch. He worked on the story. He said barbershop. But Lou Breslow, writer, interesting career from Two Reelers, working with the great comedians. But then his latest was Abbott and Costello caused a lot of imitations. Studios saw Universal raking in money hand over fist, and they all wanted their own special super comedy team to go through the roof like Abbott and Costello. So what did they do? Basically, they formed teams like Brown and Carney. We talked to them at RKO, right, Jerry?
Yep.
At RKO. Now, one of my dear friends in Hollywood was Ann Jeffries. You remember Ann Jeffries? She was, Marion Kirby on Topper and many movies at RKO, including several with Brown and Carney. Well, I talked to her once about this. The first night I met her at a party, I said, okay, I've got to ask you a few questions, and I'm going to start right now. Number one, what was it like to work with Brown and Carney? And number two, and for her mouth already had dropped open. And number two, tell me about working with Bela Lugosi and Lionel Atwill. Well, she told me that Lionel Atwill and Bela Lugosi were both charming, old world men. You know, they would kiss hands and they would bow and they were very sweet. Brown and Carney, quite interestingly, she said, they knew what they were. They were very aware of what they were. They were imitations of Abbott and Costello. Yeah. Two vaudevillians, two different styles, actually nothing like Abbott and Costello other than their countenance. You know, Alan Carney was short and dumpy, and, you know, the other one was more like Bud. But, they made a few entertaining movies. I really enjoyed Zombies on Broadway with Bela Lugosi and Genius at Work with the two I mentioned before, Lionel Atwill and Bela Lugosi, and my dear, dear late friend, Ann Jeffries. You know, she used to wear this outfit a lot. It was bright yellow and with white trim. And I always told her she looked like a broken egg. She used to like that. Anyway, so Lou Breslow wrote probably the most famous of the Abbott and Costello imitations, and that was Laurel and Hardy. Now, before you gasp and drop your tea in your lap, Laurel and Hardy would not have been signed by 20th Century Fox were it not for the success of Abbott and Costello in Buck Privates. I know that sounds sad, but it's true. So Laurel and Hardy went in and Lou Breslow wrote them Great Guns, which is, it's not a bad film, but it's not a Laurel and Hardy film. They're so unlike Laurel and Hardy in it, except in a few isolated moments. And the other one was the film that I consider to be their worst of all time, and that was A Haunting We Will Go. I just, you know, it's a Charlie Chan movie without, you know, Charlie Chan, basically. but I don't know. A lot of people say, well, what about Atoll K, their last movie? At least they were trying something different at that point. I got to give them credit for that. And that's more than I can say for A Haunting We Will Go. Mm-hmm. It didn't go far enough. So, who directed this movie? It was our old pal, the guy who directed their first film at MGM, Rio Rita, S. Sylvan Simon. Now, Jerry, maybe you can help me here.
Yes.
I try to imagine when somebody like a friend saw S. Sylvan Simon at the studio and wanted to say hello. Did he say, hello, S? Hey, S. How you doing, S? Right? Or did he say, oh, S. Sylvan. How are you, S. Sylvan? I would love to know how they approached him.
I have a feeling they may have said, hey, S.
Well, that's why he carried a squeegee with him.
Exactly.
You know, because all over his lapels. Okay, so we have Lou Breslow, who wrote for Laurel and Hardy, and S. Sylvan Simon, the director, who was basically the comedy director at MGM at that point, working with Red Skelton and Red Skelton as well. He also produced the movie Born Yesterday in 1950. Oh. Yeah, won 5 Academy Awards. That was his last thing. He died at the age of 40. Mm. Yeah, he died very young of a heart attack just before his 41st birthday. And it's a shame because he had a lot left in him. He was a really, really good comedy director. And you know what? This is my favorite of the Abbott and Costello MGM films. And I give Simon a lot of the credit. So we've got that. We've got Martin Gosch, who directed, who produced the Abbott and Costello radio show, and Lou Breslow. Okay, not only was he a comedy writer back in the golden days and this and that, he worked with everybody, he married one of my crushes of all time, Peanuts Marion Byron. Now, I'm going to have you look it up, Google it. Peanuts Byron. She was part of a short-lived comedy team from Hal Roach with Anita Garvin. They made a great movie called Tight. What was it called? With Edgar Kennedy and Stuart Irwin. And they're trying to drive to the ice cream place and they keep dropping the ice cream. And it's really good. Tight something, which refers to their being cheap. Anyway, look it up.
You can't expect us to do all the work.
Yeah. I can't do all the work. But Peanuts Byron shows up in Wheeler and Woolsey movies and you name it. She's just adorable. And she's this big. She's tiny. Look, I'm making this big. She's tiny. And that's why they called her Peanuts. Okay. So I have to say that he also worked on Bedtime for Bonzo.
Oh.
So, yeah, he had a presidential credit there. So let's get to the movie. And I'll get to the actors as we approach them, as their characters appear. So we've got the opening titles to the very upbeat finale song, On the Midway. On the Midway. So, okay, we've got the opening to the movie, and we see that it is a very high-class shishi salon, a hair salon, where you can get manicures and shaves and all that stuff. And we see the front window, and there are prominent pictures of MGM stars, of course, Clark Gable, Van Johnson, and I believe Walter Pigeon is in there too, but I don't know. He may have flown away by the time we got there. And look at that statue. Boy. He was sloppy. Okay. I just went off in a world of my own. This is big, fancy stuff. So, okay, let's start with the adorable. Now, tell me, Jerry, adorable. Jean Porter?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. And I want to bring up something that may not sit well with maybe some feminists or maybe some people who might be more sensitive to that kind of a thing. But I have a feeling S. Sylvan Simon made her turn her back to us at least a couple of times in that first scene. And she had an award-winning butt. Award-winning. Okay. Sorry, yep. But you know, I'm dwelling on her butt, but she was as cute as a button, cute as a bug's ear. So let's talk about Jean Porter. She is working at this salon and she is sort of Lou's girl in this one. We'll get to that in a minute. But Jean Porter was born in 1922 in Cisco, Texas. She lived to be 95 years old. She passed away recently in 2018. Yeah. Okay, so she worked on radio in Dallas when she was 10 years old. She also worked with Ted Lewis. Is everybody happy? For one summer in vaudeville. Hal Roach signed her in 1938. She did small roles in Hal Roach pictures, including 1 Million BC. And then finally, she ended up at MGM, where she did mostly uncredited appearances and bigger roles in the B pictures. And this may have been her largest role in Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. So here's the fascinating part about Jean Porter. She married director Edward Dimitrik in 1948. And that was just around the time that the House Un-American Committee handed out subpoenas and Edward Dimitrik got one. So what did they do? They packed up and they moved to England for a little more than 3 years, actually. They had three children there. But then his passport was expiring and he was forced to leave and go back to the States, where he got 6 months in jail, thanks to those lunatics that ran our country. And she had to support herself while he was in jail. They didn't have any money. She didn't have any prospects. And some people stepped up to help. And Dick Powell was one of them and put her in a movie called Cry Danger. And Robert Lippert and his brother gave her work in two of their films. So that helped her get along. But anyway, that was the story of Jean Porter. And Edward Dimitrik was a fine, fine director, especially film noir. Okay, so Ruthie is her name, Ruthie. And she's fighting with one of the other girls over who's going to go to Mr. Cavanaugh's office. Now, Mr. Cavanaugh is a big director, studio head at Mammoth Pictures. And this other girl wants to go because she wants to further her career, because that's what happened to Frances Rafferty's character. And I can't remember her name. That's how prominent she is in this film. But anyway, she actually did have an appointment with Mr. Cavanaugh and ended up with a studio contract, and she is now a film star. So this other woman wants to do the same thing. Ruthie says, no, I already gave it to someone else, blah, blah, blah. So who breaks up this cat fight but Chester Clute, our dear, dear character actor, Chester Clute, who says,
break it up. Now my shop is for hair cutting. Not for hair pulling.
But I find it very funny, and I'm sure it was an inside joke, that he was the head of this hair place, and he's one of the baldest actors in Hollywood, and one of my favorites, too. So anyway, we find out that Bud and Lou are down in the basement during their lunch break. No. I don't know how you feel about this, Jerry, but I think it's one of their best opening bits. We don't waste much time getting to them, and once we get to them, it's just great. They are,
oh yes,
their energy is high. Lou is ad-libbing all over the place, which he does all through this movie. Bob Thomas went to interview them on the set, and all Lou did was blow take after take because they wanted him to stick to the script. And he kept saying, we never had to learn our lines at Universal. This is horrible. I wish I were back in burlesque. but he does some of his best ad-libbing. And I don't know if you noticed in this scene, Jerry, but we're partners with him. He's looking at us the whole time. Every time he makes a decision, he looks at us almost to check with us that we're catching, you know? And Bud, as usual, is in a world of his own. But here's the deal. Bud is a actual barber. Lou is, you know, like an assistant. He does like shoe shines and stuff. And he's he's taking Bud's course in barber college. And it's a 4-year course. And he's already done 3 years. What I'm laughing about is basically Bud has a balloon head that he puts on a dummy and he lathers it, and then he expects Lou to shave it with a straight edge razor. And inevitably, it always pops and Lou gets a face full of shaving cream. And I just pictured this has been going on for 3 years. When's he going to catch on, you know? He's dumb, but is he that dumb? Yeah. But anyway, I don't know if you noticed this. I had to go back and watch it again. The first pop, you know, when he puts the blade on the balloon and it explodes, it looks like there was a very quick and subtle cut just before the pop, because you couldn't make sure that the cream was going to land the way it did all over his face. So I think they pre-did it, they cut, everybody stood still, they pre-did the cream, and then did the pop, you know? But I have a feeling that's what happened. It didn't happen the second time, because he already had the cream on his face. So anyway, it's a very funny scene. The timing especially is just, if you want to know why they were so great, and why Jerry and I love them so much, their timing, it's something to be, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's one of the few perfect things in art, I feel. Maybe my hyperbole is a little big right now.
They have pills for that now.
Do they?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I could take a pill. I've been married. Okay. So we have Abbott and Costello. They have to go to Mr. Cavanaugh's office at Mammoth Studios, give him a haircut and a shoe shine. Okay, that's their job. Now, before they get there, and again, I would love to play some sound from this. Bud asks him for his last $5 as tuition.
Now, of course, you're going into a new semester, you know.
A new what?
A new semester.
That'll be $5 in advance, please.
$5?
Of course, sir.
Ah, Buzz, look. That's all I got is $5.
That'll be
fine. No.
Well, now, please.
I got a date tonight with Ruthie.
No wonder your nerves are shot. Look at your hands. Just look at your hands. Look at how nervous you are.
You're doing that. You're shaking my hand.
They are. Am I doing that? Am I touching you? No, certainly not.
I'm nervous.
It's your nerves. Give me the $5. There you go. Well, what can they teach you in barber school that I can't teach you right here?
At least had I got my fraternity pin.
Now, watch me closely this time, will you?
Hurry up, because I want to graduate.
All right, now.
Which I found really funny. His barber college fraternity pin. But anyway, he ends up, he thought he had Bud figured out, but he put the razor on a heater by accident. And when he picked it up, it exploded the balloon. And I'm not explaining it well, but you'll watch it and it'll be good. this was on DVD, released on DVD in 2006 or 2005 from Warner. So, you know, you could buy it or rent it. Okay, so they are on their way out to go to Mr. Kavanaugh's. And who pulls up but Frances Rafferty, who is their friend. Their friend from the barbershop. And she's, you know, she's sweet and she's pretty and she's a new star. She was born in 1922 in Sioux City, Iowa. And she lasted to 81 years old. She died in 2004. Yeah, she moved to LA at the age of 9. I'm sure her parents were with her. she was signed to MGM in 1942. Played really small roles in big films. I think her first big film was Dragon Seed, where we get to see Walter Huston and Katharine Hepburn in Yellowface as they, you know, talk in platitudes and like they just ate a dumpling. So yeah, that's what she did. And this was a big role for her. And she's quite a dancer. She does some nice dancing later on during the finale. All right, so. This is one of my favorite scenes. This is where L'Espari, this is where Gregory Lemay's, and I looked it up, Lemay's in French means the corn. So anyway, so Gregory Lemay's, who is the big star at Mammoth Studios, pulls up and tries to get Frances Rafferty to go to his beach house with him that afternoon. But she has a date with Ruthie, Lou Costello's girlfriend, and he says, someday I hope to have a date with my girlfriend.
Ruthie. I gotta break the date.
What date?
Do you remember? June 22nd?
June 22nd. I don't remember anything about a date.
Oh, yes. But you remember I said I was gonna take you to the Palladium a long time ago? And you said see me next year? Well, tonight, the year is up.
Abercrombie, you're so impulsive.
And that explains their relationship perfectly. Okay, I also wanted to mention about Frances Rafferty. In 1954... she became a regular character on December Bride, very, very popular sitcom starring Spring Byington and Henry Morgan and Kara Williams. And she was on 7 episodes of the spinoff, Pete and Gladys. These are maybe my earliest memories of television as a child, watching reruns of these two ancient shows. But anyway, yeah, she worked there, and she retired in 1965, came back to do one more job in 1977 on the streets of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what a nice career she had. Not a big star, not a well-known name, but she worked, boy. She worked. Okay, so there's some dialogue here that I would love for you to hear, where Lou confuses Gregory Lemay's name.
Hello there.
Oh, hello.
Wolf.
Hi, Mr. Walsh.
No, that's Greg Lemay's, the great crooner.
Hello, Mr. Crooner.
Shut up.
Hi, Mr. Shut Up.
Will you keep quiet?
Lou is just going nuts in this movie. He's just going nuts. I love it. I just love it. All right, so they go to Mammoth Studios, where they are working in the office of... It's not Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Kavanaugh is Donald McBride. Pardon me. And he's the filmmaker and studio head. This is an agent, a very big, big agent, Norman Royce. And he's played by Warner Anderson, very popular character actor, worked into the television years. And he's one of those typical, he represents those typical empty-hearted, soulless Hollywood people, ones that I've broken bread with in the past. Lord knows I could only break bread because they wouldn't pay for my meal. I broke it in frustration. So this agent, he's a creep. And Bud and Lou are watching him do business. It seems like every time he picks up the phone, he makes another $2,000, $25,000, whatever it is. And he says, yeah, this is great. Every time I pick up the phone, I get 10%. So Bud and Lou are quite taken by this, but they're visited by Robert Stanton, as he's billed. And he is a young hopeful from Des Moines, he says. And he knew, or Norman Royce knew his father and supposedly was in business with him, but doesn't remember him at all. You could see that, you know, as he's talking to him. So he thought he could get a break by coming in and you know, riding on that. So Robert Stanton, interesting fellow, born in White Plains, New York in 1923, died at 65 in 1989 of ALS. He's the brother of singer Dick Hames, a very, very popular singer in the 1940s. He replaced Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Band when Frank went solo. And he also went solo and managed to get a contract at 20th Century Fox, introduced really some really good stuff. The more I see you, the more I want you. Anyway, he that was terrible what I just did. And I consider myself a singer. And how weird. The more I see you, the more I want you. La da 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 dum. La da da dum. Okay. I was attacked by a duck at one point. So yeah, he was married four times. These Hames boys were difficult. Dick was married six times, by the way, once to Rita Hayworth. But he was born in, I believe it was Buenos Aires, Dick Hames. And he had trouble with his citizenship, especially during World War II, and they were going to deport him. And he got into all kinds of trouble. He was a real jerk. He used to beat up Rita Hayworth, and you know, he drank too much and all that. He was just not a nice person, from what I understand. But anyway, Robert Stanton, his brother, Robert Hames, was also a composer. He wrote one standard that would have supported him, actually. It was the song called That's All. La da 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 la da 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 la da 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 la da 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 da. That's all. That's all. That song was a huge hit and became part of the American Songbook. And he wrote, he wrote the lyrics to that song, and that supported him for a while. But anyway, he did some early TV. Where is it? Well, he did on the Dumont Network, and that's not the Margaret Dumont Network. this is just the Dumont Network. And he did an early sitcom called It's a Business, where he played a music publisher. And he ended up, here we go, when I say that these guys were not exactly my type of people, he ended up running Nixon's TV campaign for his 1968 presidential run. So, so there he was. That's our Robert Stanton. Well, he comes in and he gets an audition right then and there. He kind of shames Norman Royce into it. And the whole time, we have to remember, Bud and Lou are watching all of this. So Robert Stanton sits down and sings the only real decent song in the movie. And the songs were written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. Now, interestingly, the year before, they had written the score to, what was it called? I can't believe this. It's on TCM every 5 minutes. Judy Garland, have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Meet me in St. Louis.
Be sure to bring me pills. Yeah, meet me in St. Louis. That's it. thank you. I completely forgot. I'm getting so old. I'm not sure if that was the exact lyric, but yeah. But that wasn't it was the intent. the year before, they wrote that glorious score, and then they wrote the score for Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. This is a song called As I Remember You.
I think of all the foolish things we used to do. I raise my glass and drink a toast or two, as I remember you. A breeze begins to sigh.
As I remember you. It's actually not bad. I can't say that for the subsequent songs, but this one definitely could have worked. I guess. So anyway, he's listening, and who should walk in mid-audition, mid-song, but Gregory LeMay's The Corn.
Dun, dun,
dun. Children of the Corn. he hears this. He immediately feels insecure because he had given up a role in a film opposite Frances Rafferty. And mm-hmm. kind of to get revenge on her not going to the beach house with him. And this agent decides that, hey, this is easy now. I can replace you with this new guy. And right away, Gregory LeMay's hackles stand on end. And he decides to do the film, thus eliminating Bob Stanton's, you know, big break. But before that happens, during the song, as Lou is listening, you know, intently, and you see him doing the shoe shine, as Norman Royce leaves the office, we see that his white pants and shoes are now almost entirely black with shoe shine stains. And we love it because he deserves it. So Bud and Lou decide that they are going to become agents and they are going to help this guy because they heard the machinations between LeMay's and Norman Royce. They want to help this kid. So they do this telephone routine. Now, this is where I talk about John Grant. I'm kind of happy he wasn't aboard because they invented new bits for Abbott and Costello in this film.
Yeah.
This telephone bit. They only added a few of their old jokes, you know, do you ever ride a jackass, which they did in Ride 'em Cowboy.
Yeah.
And there was another one they do. I forget what it was. But yeah, it's a very funny scene with phones. They don't know that they're talking to each other and they keep switching off the phones. And it's fun. It's really kind of fun.
Yeah.
Almost Ritz Brothers like. So anyway, they do that. They decide they're going to help this guy. And Frances Rafferty, Bob Stanton, Bud and Lou, and Gene Porter, who is Lou's date, they all decide to celebrate. And they go to that big Hollywood nightclub, Ciro's. Now, here's my connection to this film. I used to be one of the Comedy Store players in Hollywood. Hmm. And Ciro's became the Comedy Store.
Ah.
So there you go. They were sitting in Ciro's and, you know, I performed there many, many times.
Nice.
Yeah, really cool. Really cool. And I never realized that before as I was watching the movie last night. So they find out that Bob is out and they're all very depressed. And Lou disappears at one point and they're wondering where he is. And they look up and he's selling cigarettes, cigars, and they fade out on that. And I see. I don't think John Ford. I don't think John Grant would have come up with that, you know, ending. He would have gone to something old, possibly, you know, or whatever. Yeah, interesting to think about, you know, how just his lack of presence is almost enhancing to this film.
Yeah.
So they write that new the telephone routine. They do Ciro's. So they decide they're going to go to the studio and actually take the bull by the horns and talk to Kavanaugh and try to get Bob his job back. So I'm leaving out one of my favorite scenes, and it takes place in the barbershop. Rags Ragland. I can't believe I forgot this. Before they leave the shop, before they do the whole thing with Gregory LeMay's and Mr. Wolf and all that stuff, Rags Ragland, the burlesque comic who has for the past 5 years have been under contract to MGM playing supporting roles, comedic supporting roles. But it's interesting how he followed the trajectory that Abbott and Costello had in that Rags Ragland was considered maybe the funniest single comedian in burlesque at the time. He was wild. He was known to ad lib like crazy. He was known to walk in on other people's scenes at random. But mostly he was known for his sexual proclivities offstage. He was a partier times 10. In fact, and this is very interesting. This is what drew me to his story. First of all, he was born in Louisville, Kentucky. So he's a Southern boy. And I don't know if you can tell that from his real name, John Lee Morgan Beauregard Ragland.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I'm dripping with corn pone Gregory LeMays. So anyway, he's from the Deep South. He does various jobs in Kentucky, gets married at, like, I think it was 1922. His only wife has one child, John Jr., and he divorces his wife in 1926, moves to Los Angeles in 27, and becomes involved with burlesque, much like Lou did when Lou was floundering around wondering what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. So here's the story. This is the story I love about Rags Ragland. Phil Silvers was his best friend and his part-time partner in burlesque. And Frank Sinatra also was one of his best friends, and they adored Rags Ragland. So in 1946, the year after this movie was made, Rags and Phil Silvers were booked into the Copacabana in New York. Now, this is always a huge booking. Copacabana was the top of the heap.
Yeah.
And what happened was, before that booking, Rags went out one night on a binge, an alcoholic binge with Orson Welles, and came back the following morning, and he started complaining about abdominal pain, and it was really bad. So anyway, Sinatra called in his specialists and all that to look at him, and it turns out that he fell into a coma, all due to his drinking. This was all about his drinking. His organs were shutting down. And at his deathbed was Phil Silvers and Frank Sinatra. Mm. So fast forward to early 1947. It's time for the booking at the Copacabana. Phil Silvers had signed his contract, so had to do it regardless. Yeah. Sinatra was making a movie with Jimmy Durante called It Happened in Brooklyn. And he pissed off MGM by walking off the movie, going back to New York, and playing Rags' role with Phil Silvers at the Copacabana.
Wow.
For his friend. And at the end of the show, Phil would take a bow for Rags. Now, you don't find that anymore. You know, that's just like dedication, you know, times 10. Just fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Good for you, Frank and Phil. Anyway, so that's Rags Ragland. That's the story. They do a scene together. You could tell they were buddies. You know, they must have been buddies in burlesque. They work beautifully together. Their timing is right on. Some of the jokes are really funny. I love when he spins the chair around and he starts lathering up his shoes. And then when he realizes what he's doing, he takes the shoe off and starts lathering his face with the shoe. Lou is just out of control. He's out of control in this movie. He's just ad-libbing like crazy. But anyway, it has a very clever ending where he decides to use the trick that Bud used during class by switching out the razor, the straight edge part, for the other side. So he was able to scrape the cream off of Rags's face really fast. And of course, he didn't do anything. It's still all there, and he looks ridiculous. So he decides, he asks for a mirror. Now, this is one of my favorite moments. He goes, let me see a mirror. And Lou just says, what size? This is like in the Buck Privates. What time is it? You know, just throwing it out there. What size? And Rags comes back with, well, if you just, what do I care what size it is? Like the true professional that he was. So Bud is watching offstage with Gene Porter, and they're like petrified. Now he's going to see that Lou didn't do anything. And Lou sees Rags's picture, his 8x10 on the wall, takes it off, puts it in front of the mirror, and shows it to him. And Rags says one of my favorite lines in the movie. It's not really funny, but if you've ever been to Hollywood and tried to make it in movies, you'll know. He looks at the picture and he says,
gee, I look about 10 years younger.
I think so.
That's very good. Thank you.
And that's what people do in Hollywood. They use pictures that are 10 years old. But anyway, that's a wonderful scene. Just a wonderful scene. Okay, so let's move up to where we are now. They were just in the office. They decided to become agents. They go to Ciro's to celebrate. Bob loses the role. So the boys go to the studio. And that's where they meet our friend, Jumping Butterballs, Donald McBride. Now, Donald McBride is Mr. Cavanaugh. He's the big director, screen guy. And it's Mammoth Studios. Couldn't get any bigger than Mammoth Studios. Mm-hmm. Mammoth. Sorry. So, Donald McBride, let's talk about him a little bit as we approach him, his bombastic self. He was born in Brooklyn, like most funny men. born in Brooklyn in 1893, and he lived till 1957. He was only 63 when he passed away. And I think about it, he died of a heart attack, and I was thinking, that's from dealing with the Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello and Martin and Lewis. Who wouldn't die of a heart attack? He was the veteran of 140 films, over 140 films, from 1916 up to 1955. I spotted him when I went to see a very, very muddy bootleg print of Animal Crackers before the big re-release. I was sitting in the audience, and I'm watching this mud on the screen, and I still recognized Donald McBride standing like off to the back with a little mustache. And only later, when they came out with the Blu-ray, did I realize he had a line. He says a line to Margaret Dumont as Captain Spaulding. He's here, or he's coming, or something like that. So this is a guy who worked with Abbott and Costello on this film, their next film, Little Giant, which happens to be my favorite Donald McBride performance. He plays the harried conductor on the train, and it is belly laugh stuff. That's how funny it is. He worked with them on also, he did The Time of Their Lives, and then Buck Privates Come Home. So he worked with the boys quite a bit. I know they liked him. Most comics did. He was a great foil. He worked with Martin and Lewis in The Stooge and then again in Sailor Beware, although that might be reversed as far as chronologically, and with the Bowery Boys in one of their better films, The Jinx Money, and then Bowery Battalion. And his final film was The 7-Year Itch for Billy Wilder. So not a bad career for Mr. Donald McBride, who came to us from Broad. Well, actually, he started out in silent movies, just doing a couple. But then he came back and started working for Vitaphone, Warner Brothers' short subject studio in New York. And he worked with Roscoe Arbuckle, Fatty Arbuckle, and Shemp Howard, and you name it, Bob Hope, early Bob Hope, before they ever made features, or before he ever made a feature. And then eventually he went to Broadway, where he created Mr. Wagner in Room Service, and then RKO signed him up for the film version with the Marx Brothers, and that started a almost 20-year career in film and television. If you're a fan of the Colgate Comedy Hour, he does a great bit with Martin and Lewis, where Lewis is pretending to be a ventriloquist dummy, and it's not too far a stretch. Okay. So that is Donald McBride, a wonderful, wonderful man. So I love this. Donald McBride is seen driving his big fancy car through the gates of the studio. He tells the studio cop, Edgar Deering, and the other one is Robert Emmett O'Connor. And Buster Keaton did a film. His first film was called Free and Easy. And it took place at MGM, just like this one. And in fact, they use a few of the gags that Buster used in Free and Easy. And interestingly, one of the cops who chased Buster in 1929 was Edgar Deering, who is now chasing Lou through the studio. So yeah, very interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, so we get there and Kavanaugh tells the boys, I just had this car repaired. Please be careful with it. It took forever to get done because of wartime, shortages. So please be very careful. And as he's saying that, you hear an enormous crash and you turn around and there's Lou and Bud driving right into his car and destroying it. And they have a scene. They're very belligerent towards each other. They scream at each other. And this is just setting up the fact that they have to do business together later on. It's a very two-reeler setup. So Bud and Lou actually sneak onto the lot. They run on. And Kavanaugh says, you catch those guys. And if I see them on the lot, I'm not only going to fire you, I'm going to fire the entire police force here. And he meant it, boy. He even wanted to say jumping butterballs, but he didn't. He held it in, and that might have been what gave him the heart attack. I'm not sure. So Bud and Lou are doing a bunch of studio stuff, and I know that this is where Buster really came in to town. Bud ends up on a line of extras, and he gets a police outfit to wear in the casting office. So that's good for him. He could dress like a cop and they'll leave him alone. And he could look for Lou. Lou, on the other hand, ends up at a casting call for tramps, bums, you know, hobos. And it's so funny. The casting director is looking at the guys as they're coming out, and they look terrible. They're all, you know, 5 o'clock shadow, old stinking clothes. And he's like ripping them up and saying, "You don't look enough like a bum." And then he tear the clothes. And then Lou walks up in his normal clothes, and the guy says, you're perfect. Go ahead. So... And Lou gives us a nice take before we end up where he is going. And this may be the most brutal Lou Costello scene in their canon, in their history, the Klondike Pete scene. Mm-hmm. Now, some people find it difficult to watch. That's how brutal it is. I mean, if you're – okay, here's the setup. Lou is hiding on the set, and it is a Western scene, and there is an upstairs to this set, and downstairs is the gambling casino saloon. It's an old Western scene. Okay, upstairs, Lou has to be a dummy. He has to pretend he's a dummy, and they take him up the stairs, and his head bounces on every step. And you hear it. I mean, it's brutal. They get him up there. And they put him in the lap of, or actually they put in his lap, Marion Martin, who is mm-hmm. one of the most gorgeous women ever to walk before a camera. She was a Ziegfeld girl for years. Mm-hmm. And if you go online, if you Google Marion Martin, if you write nude, some beautifully tasteful, gorgeous, sexy pictures during her Ziegfeld years. And she's just stunning. She was supposed to be in Go West, and she got ill. And was replaced by June McCloy. And it's funny, Matthew Conium says, well, maybe this was a way to make that up, you know, for her, this Western scene, you know. And it's certainly funnier than anything in Go West.
So she
dodged a major bullet there. So anyway, she's sitting on Lou's lap. He's supposed to be a dummy. And who walks in but our buddy, Mike Mazurki. Huge Mike Mazurki filling out that doorway. And his job is to take Lou and beat the crap out of him and throw him off the balcony, mm-hmm. which he does. Not before he bounces his head against the ceiling about 20 times. And then punches Lou, and Lou falls off the balcony and crashes onto a table, breaking it, of course. And then the director thinks, no, this isn't a tea dance. This is, you know, a fight. Give me something really rough. And of course, Lou is like looking at us like, what the hell? So again, they take him upstairs and they set him up, and Mike Mazurki comes in again. And he ends up hitting Mike Mazurki and then jumping off the balcony himself, landing on the roulette wheel. It spins and sends him flying onto some other table, which collapses under him. Anyway, it's a very funny scene. It's very brutal. And Arthur Space, playing the director, he was in Rio Rita as well. He was one of the bad guys. He is so funny in this scene. He's so clueless. Anyway, so Lou suffers again in this scene, and it's a biggie. This is a biggie. I noticed one thing about MGM. When Buster Keaton went to MGM and made that huge mistake of going there, they turned him into a character called Elmer. And during the course of the films, he was always referred to as like an idiot, you know, a moron. Who's this idiot? And, you know, we don't like to see Keaton that way. You know, Keaton was a very, you know, he was a go-getter in his films. He was brilliant. Well, in this MGM film, I noticed that three times Abbott and Costello are referred to in kind of very condescending ways. The first one is, where are those two fatheads? The other one is, you keep those monkeys out of my way. Fatheads, monkeys. What was the other one? I wrote it down. Well, anyway, it's another condescending way of referring to them. Those morons or something like that. So, okay. There was also a scene in the studio. Lou is hiding in the studio school where the kid actors go to school. Well, the teacher's not there. There is a drawing of Lassie on the blackboard, and Lou asks if that's their teacher. The kids are Jackie Butch Jenkins and what's her name? McManus, Sharon McManus. They're two young, you know, up and coming youngsters at MGM, which means they never get anything funny to do. But in this scene, this is sort of a hybrid scene. These guys sort of borrowed from the John Grant book. This is sort of Jonah and the Whale.
Yes.
And this is like the third time they're going back for that.
Yes.
It's a little different because it's not Bud torturing him. It's little children, you know, asking questions. And it's not Jonah and the Whale. It's Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
And they also include the, how did he get up in the tree? He sat on it when it was an acorn. All of that. Now, when I was a kid, I loved, this scene was my favorite scene in the movie. Because yeah. I was a kid, right? Right, Jerry?
Oh, yeah.
These kids,
oh, yeah.
These kids were, you know, getting away with stuff, and I loved it. Now I watch it, and I think, let's move on. They're not quite as cute as I remembered. But anyway, so Lou stops to do that, and again, the chase continues. There are gags done with, like, there's one where Bud helps Lou over a brick wall, and after he throws him over the wall, two stagehands take the wall away. It wasn't really a wall. It was a facade. And you see Lou on his, you know, on his butt on the other side. That's Buster Keaton. It's Buster yep. Keaton. The whole yep. thing with the two doors, the
yes.
prop doors. Yeah. And Edgar Deering is running after him and in and out of the doors. And after a while, he loses him. And the camera pans up and Lou is laying down on top of the doors out of sight. And, you know, kind of a Bugs Bunny gag.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I'm not going to forgive myself if I don't go back and mention one thing. Please forgive me, folks. I'm a little scattered today. While Lou is taking his lessons from Bud, the barber lessons, uh-huh. and the first explosion happens, Lou has one of his lines that you just can't get out of your head because it's so wrong. He pops the thing, and Bud chastises him, and Lou says, "Oh, I'm making such an unsuccessful attempt all the time." What? This is what Lou meant about, let me just do what I do. Let me just say what I want to say. But I just found that line so funny. Okay, so the scene after the Ciro's scene is probably the most famous scene in the movie. And that is the insomnia scene. Or as Lou says, insomniam namnia. Now, as a person who suffers from extreme insomnia, this goes right to my heart, this one. And Lou cannot sleep. He's having trouble. He can't sleep. So he asks Bud to help him out. And Bud happens to have a record that is set to put you to sleep. It's kind of like I do it for YouTube. I go on YouTube and put on like storm sounds, rain or in the background, and it yep. helps me to sleep. So this is a guy, a doctor. That's right. Put your head on the pillow. Now attach your head to your body and do it again. No. So this guy is an expert at putting people to sleep, not unlike our current president. And he puts the record on and Lou falls asleep. It works. Unfortunately, when it gets to the end of the record, the needle is going, you know, as it gets to the end, and that wakes up Lou. That annoys him to the point where he wakes up. And then Bud says, I'll stay here and I'll make sure you're asleep, and then I'll take the record off. But Bud falls asleep listening to the guy, and it still goes back to, and poor Lou has to wake up and wake up Bud. Lou does a funny thing here, and I'd like to think that he brought it to the table because it just seems a little personal. Every time he gets out of bed,
yes,
he scratches his stomach, puts on his bathrobe, and closes the window. He does those three things every time he gets out of bed, and it's very funny. It's a running gag. So Bud decides that the only way to solve this problem so he won't hear the record is to put cotton in his ears. And this is the scene people love. Every time one of them has cotton in their ears, they can't hear what the other one is saying. And it just goes back and forth.
Now, how's that? Huh? Everything all right?
Huh?
How's that? All right?
Huh?
Is that all right?
Huh?
I said, is that all right?
Is that all right?
Oh, yeah.
Stuff in the ears.
Yes, yes, you can't hear. Swell. Come on. Then when you go to sleep, I'll turn it off.
Take it off, yeah.
Okay, go
These
ahead.
Are good, huh?
Go ahead, get your sleep.
Now I know I'll get some sleep.
Huh?
I says, I know I'll get some sleep.
Huh?
I said, I know I'll get some sleep.
Huh?
I'm going to get some sleep.
What?
I says, I'm going to get some sleep.
That's what I'm here for.
Well, what do you keep saying?
Huh?
Shh. Huh?
I can't
huh?
hear you, please.
Well, then keep me your ears, and you don't have to listen to nothing.
What?
You don't have to listen to nothing.
Huh?
You don't have to listen to nothing.
Look, wait a minute. Now, listen, don't get excited. Please, will you? With these in my ears, I can't hear. Look, here, try it yourself now. See that? Can you hear anything?
What?
Can you hear me?
Huh?
You can't hear anything, can you?
How can I hear if you're going to put these in my ears like that? I mean, after all, I can't hear if you got them in my ears.
Huh?
If you got them in my he's got them again. I'm going to...
What do you want me to do?
I'm going to go to sleep.
So it's all wonderful and great. Now, the thing I can't understand is what happens to Bud? He disappears in the middle of this scene. He's gone. Lou throws a book at him at one point to wake him up, and Bud's gone. Now, I'm thinking, from what I hear and what I've read, they went back to enhance this scene with the cotton bit. It wasn't there at the beginning. And I think the editing of that, pushing that in, because they had to go back for retakes to MGM.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of them. So Bud disappears, you know, like willy-nilly. But they do this wonderful, wonderful bit. And they actually took this bit out and put it in That's Entertainment Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the actual highlights of the film. And I remember I went to see that film quite a few times because I wanted to support it, you know, in those days.
Yeah.
And it never failed. That bit never failed to get like big laughs, you know. So how cool. So they do the insomnia. And at one point he tells Lou to keep a stiff upper lip, which is exactly what Lou tries to do before like slaps it out of his face. okay. So they have to decide, how are we going to get Bob, his part back? How are we going to get him back into the movie? And the only way they can get him back is to get rid of Gregory LeMaize, to discredit him. So in true burlesque fashion, Bud decides to take a camera and take a picture of him hitting someone. And that would get him arrested. And, you know, Mammoth Studios would not want to hire him. So they decide who is going to get the punch in the nose. And I think we could agree that we knew it was going to be Lou at that point. you know, we just skipped to my Lou. And so, sorry, I've been watching Carson lately doing Art Fern, the Tea Time movie, which is basically Jackie Gleason doing Reggie Van Gleason.
Yeah.
So, that's what they're going to do. So they know that he's going out on his yacht. Gregory LeMaize is going out on his yacht. They are going to approach him on the yacht. Lou is going to insult him. And LeMaize is going to punch him. And Bud will get the picture. And that's that. Okay. So what happens? He chastises LeMaize. LeMaize punches Lou. Lou flies off the boat into the water and does not come up. Bud and LeMaize are very concerned. Bud immediately starts pointing a finger at LeMaize as a murderer. LeMaize is like, he's nervous. I can't believe this is happening, blah, blah, blah. So Bud gets to do one of his great scenes. You know, Bud has certain scenes that Bud Abbott fans love. One
yes.
is pack and unpack, you know,
yep.
when he goes off. He just goes off on a Bud Abbott-like fantasy. And in this one, we get to see him feel remorse about Lou and his relationship with Lou. And he starts talking about how abusive he's been to Lou and how if he were back, I would treat him differently. And he was my best friend and da, 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 da. In the middle of this monologue, Lou staggers in behind him very quietly. Bud has no idea he's there. And of course, he's got fish jumping out of every pocket, out of his pot. And he's soaking wet and Bud is still going off about, you know, my buddy, my best friend. And Lou finally joins in with him and Bud sees him and immediately they go back to their old relationship. He throws a towel in his face and what are you doing? What are you crazy? Blah, 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 blah. Interestingly, the man behind the counter at the diner where Lou is entering and Bud is talking, that is Milton Kibbe. Guy Kibbe's little brother, who made more movies than Guy and played smaller parts, mostly bit uncredited. But that's Milton Kibbe, if you want to look at him. He's got he's similar in his face to Guy. But anyway, so that's Milton Kibbe. I just thought you'd be interested. Okay, yeah. So apparently I was wrong. All right, so Bud and Lou are back to their old relationship, thank goodness. And they decide that they have to hide Lou. They have to continue the ruse that LeMay's killed Lou. And it makes all the newspapers. It makes the front pages. It's just amazing. And you know, speaking of amazing, I got some footage, actually a sound bite from Kevin Brownlow, our friend in Great Britain. And this may be one of the most important scenes from Bud Abbott's career. And this was recorded during one of their earlier films. I believe it was Arthur Lubin who is directing them in this sound clip, and you'll hear it. You'll hear what. Let me just put it on. Thanks. Thank you for your patience, Jerry. Hold on, 1 second.
All right, Bud. Let's start with the joke. We'll go with the joke. Okay. Sound okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. Good. Let's move on. Okay. Ready? Action.
Tell me, where all the little bugs go in the winter?
Search me.
No, thanks. I just thought I'd ask.
Cut! No. Reverse that. Lou, you take his line, and Bud, you take the other line, okay? And listen, it's not a great joke. So when we get to the ending, can you give me something like an exclamation point? Something to finish the scene? Huh? Can you do that?
Certainly, I can do that. Yes, certainly. Let's go.
All right. Sound okay?
Sounds okay!
All right. Now, ready? Action!
Tell me, Buzz, where do all the little bugs go in the winter? Search me.
No, thanks. I just thought I'd ask.
Bud, what are you doing?
Cut!
What's the matter?
Bud, no, you can't, like, stick your thumb in his eye. That's not good. That's not a good... No, that's not good. That's stooge stuff. We don't want to go there, okay? So let's try it one more time. Just come up with something, please. Something to end the scene, to give it that punch, okay? Here we go. Ready? Is sound okay?
Sound's still good.
All right, good. Ready? Action. Tell me, where do all the little bugs go in the winter?
Search me.
No, thanks. I just thought I'd ask.
That's it! Cut! You've got it! That's it! A slap! Of course! Do it again, just to make sure. Yes, that's good!
Thank you, Bud. Thanks for coming up with that. Would somebody wake Lou? Lou, would you?
That's all we have. But that is a seminal moment in their careers. We thought it was burlesque where the slap was, but apparently they came up with it on the set. Okay, let's move on because I see Jerry's about to pull his own head off and eat it like an apple. All right. Which is virtually impossible. Okay. Woo! Lou is dead and LeMay's is on the hideout and he wants to get to the bottom of everything. He's in disguise at a bar just outside the studio. And he's sitting at the bar, and who should walk in but Lou with his own phony beard. They both have phony beards because they're both in hiding. The bartender, by the way, is Joe Devlin. Joe Devlin, who always reminded me of Lou, actually. Joe Devlin played Mussolini in those funny Hal Roach streamliners about Hitler. I know. Believe me, they're probably the most tasteless movies ever made. Well, I have to say, you know, they're kind of funny. They turned Hitler, Hirohito, and Mussolini into like the Three Stooges, and it's really funny. So anyway, they're revealed. They see each other. LeMay's is like beside himself because he knows that Lou is alive, and this was all something to get him out of the way. And this starts the big chase. Unfortunately, it also starts the big finale. This movie was choreographed by Chuck Walters, who became a big musical director at MGM. And he is actually the guy dancing with Francis Rafferty in this, this horrible number. But anyway, what's going on while this number is happening? It leads to a big explosion at the end. For some reason, the set has to be blown up after the final note of this song. And I think some of the audience members might have volunteered to blow up the set at this point. But anyway, this chase is going on. And one of our fans, one of the fans of the podcast, Matt Belfiore, I believe that's how you pronounce it. And he brought up interesting observations. Now, this chase scene takes place mostly on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a roller coaster with a rear projection, and, you know, it's very well done. But he brings up the point that it's a lot like a movie called Strike Me Pink from 1936, Samuel Goldwyn, Eddie Cantor movie. It was the last movie he made for Goldwyn. And the whole finale is on a roller coaster. And a lot of the same things happen to him, you know, with the axle balancing on it, balancing on one wheel. So that was like almost 10 years before. So yeah, maybe it was time for another roller coaster thing. My only point was Laurel and Hardy had just done it in The Dancing Masters.
Yes.
Right? Ollie's stuck on the bus and is going up and down. I can't say that the special effects were anywhere near the country of believable, but it was pretty terrible, pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But this one, it really moves. It's a lot of fun. People are getting thrown around, and it all ends with the explosion. Now, I'm wondering, this explosion goes off, and supposedly, I think it happens early because Lou sits on the plunger and sets it off, which would mean everyone would die. You know, they were talking about at this specific point, you have to be in the safety zones. He gives this whole speech at the beginning, Kavanaugh, and it just explodes willy-nilly. And you think to yourself, I wonder what happened. But it doesn't matter because we cut right to the final scene.
If I may.
Yes, please.
It actually happens late.
Oh, it happens late. Oh, Bud hits him on the head.
It's supposed to go off and something happens. Unfortunately, I don't remember the specifics, but
I do.
It was supposed to go off and it didn't. And then it happens because Lou
sits
now
on
that
the
he's
plunger.
Off the roller coaster, he's, oh, everything's fine now, sits down on the plunger.
Right. Now, the thing I remember is that it was supposed to go off when the meter hit number 4.
Yep.
Right? And Bud knew that. And he had a microphone in his hand, and he hits the assistant director and knocks him out with the microphone so he wouldn't give the cue to blow up the set. Right? So, like you say, it happens late. Lou sits on it. Everything blows up. But in the next scene, they are finally Hollywood agents. They have a huge telephone that when they pick it up, it acts like a cash register. And the thing opens up and there's like $1 million inside. Their dream comes true. Every time they pick up the phone, they make money. And that's the end of the movie. And, you know, it's a fun, satisfying ending. I think it's good. And Gene Porter is there with them. Now, if you noticed, I don't know if you did, but I noticed this from childhood, actually, when I would watch this movie. And again, this one did not come around like the Universals did.
Right.
This was actually part of all three MGM films were part of a CBS affiliate in New York. And they would only show them maybe once a year, maybe. So I never could get quite familiar with them like I did, you know, the Universals. So yeah, the big phone ended up at the Costello home. Right near their swimming pool, right?
Yep.
And Lou would play with it and make the kids laugh and this and that. He was the magpie of show business. He would just steal everything that wasn't nailed down. And in a way, I write this in the book, I understand that. He supported the studio, for crying out loud. That was his stuff. I don't care what you say. Okay, so we come to the end of Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. And I have to say, it's my favorite of the three MGMs. I think it's the most palatable. I love their energy and youth in Rio Rita. But the movie itself is not as engrossing as this one, I think.
Right.
This is really zany. It's wacky. It's got new stuff and mixed with a little of the old stuff. The New York Times, stuffy Bosley Crowther, actually says that he wishes Lou Costello would get material as good as he is. He called him a brilliant pantomimic talent. That's something from Bosley Crowther. He did not give out compliments very readily. So that's it. They're done with MGM. They disliked working there. They did not make as much money, and they were more than ready to go back to Universal, where one of their most interesting films was waiting for them. This was a change of pace, requested, actually, by Lou. And this was a way of possibly getting back the audience that they were slowly losing. The audience was depleting a bit by this point. They were so overexposed. So they thought that maybe something new would change things. And that's what we're going to be looking at next time as we look at Little Giant. Lou takes on the vacuum cleaner salesman job and works for two Bud Abbotts. Not at the same time, but you know what I'm saying. So interesting stuff, and it should be a lot of fun. And it's actually a movie I like very much. So let's make a date for a couple of weeks. Jer, how about that?
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Okay, me too. And I look forward to talking to all of you out there. I hope you're enjoying yourself. Again, we will tell you that our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, is for sale at Amazon.com, also at McFarlane Publishing. You can get it. And if you want to mail it to me, I would be happy to sign it and mail it back to you. And let's see, the Abbott and Costello movies, the Universal box set, is available both in DVD and Blu-ray. And Warner Archive has a lot of the films that aren't represented there, including Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. I'm really looking forward to that one, by the way. Mm-hmm. So we will see you next time in a very different mood with Little Giant. We'll see you next time.
It's the Big Podcast. It's the one where we meet Bud and Lou with a real podcast, meaning me and Jerry too. We discuss movies, only those that feature you know who. Lou and Abbott become a habit as they meet the podcast.